time, I'd like to inform all participants today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you. All right, my name's Chuck Gomes. I think most of you know me, or at least know who I am. I'm the GNSO Council Vice Chair, and I'm chairing this meeting in Aubrey's absence because she's traveling. I want to introduce and thank Glenn de Saint-Jury for her always excellent support in arranging the call and all the other things she does to make it happen. I want to introduce Kurt Pritz, who's ICANN's Senior Vice President of Services. And I'm going to ask Kurt, are there any other staff that you're expecting to be on the call that you would like to introduce, Kurt?
Is Olaf, are you on?
Oh, yes, I am.
Yep, Olaf's on.
Marika's on, too.
Hi, Marika. I think that's it.
Okay, very good. Because of time limitations, I'm not going to ask all of you to identify yourself because that would take up too much of our time. But what I would ask, when you first are called on to comment or ask a question, please give your full name and what organization you're representing, or if you're just representing yourself, that's fine too. And then after that, each time that you speak, please identify yourself. Let me quickly go over, and some of you may have received these as Glenn sent them out this morning, a few ground rules. Thank you. A few ground rules that I would appreciate everyone following. We'd like to, at least at first, restrict comments and questions, in other words, active participation in the call, to those who had submitted questions and comments to the ICANN public comment site. Now, what I will try to do, assuming we have some time at the end, is open it up to others if you want to add something. I can't guarantee there will be time because we've got a lot of ground to cover, but I will do that if we have time. Please, comments and questions should relate to the issues of the draft new GTLD applicant guidebook and the associated supplementary documents posted on the ICANN site. This is not the time to rehash issues regarding the GNSO recommendation came out of the PDP process. It's okay that you submit comments like that, obviously, on the public forum, but let's not use the time to rehash those issues now, even if you disagreed with one of the recommendations. The Q&A session is going to be organized by module. Questions and comments should be restricted to the module that we're talking about at a given point in time. When asking a question or making a comment, it would be very much appreciated by, I think, everyone on the call, and especially Kurt and Olaf, that you cite the guidebook section number and page number, and if possible, the paragraph or something, some other identifier, so that it can be easily identified. We're going to start out with Module 3, but it's important to note that we spent quite a bit of time on Sunday in Cairo talking about Module 3. We'd appreciate it, especially those that were involved there, if you try not to repeat questions or comments that were made there, because those are already in the record, unless you think further explanation is needed. To ensure that there's plenty of time to cover all modules, I'm going to limit each module to no more than 30 minutes. In the case of Module 3, because we have already spent quite a bit of time on that one, I'm going to cut that off at 30 minutes into the call, so we'll have less than 30 minutes for Module 3. If there's time left over at the end, we can come back if we run short on any of the modules. I'm going to assume that everyone's reviewed all the relevant documents. If Kurt wants to do a 1 or 2 minute introduction by a module, that's okay. But we're not going to use time for him doing an overview of the modules in each case, but rather focus on the questions and comments. I'm going to be managing the queue. Wish me luck in that regard. I'll try to periodically ask for those who would be added to the queue. If I'm not very good at that, just try to find a convenient place to interrupt me, and I'll get you down. I'll also try to allow follow-up questions if it works out okay to a particular point. In other words, let somebody jump into the queue if it's specifically related to what we're talking about at the time. We'll see if that works effectively. I'll try to do that. The meeting, as you already heard, is being recorded. It may be transcribed, but I wouldn't count on a transcription because we don't have the transcribers that were used in Cairo that do a great job, and so it's using the telephone company transcription is pretty time-consuming. So unless it's a huge demand by people, count on the MP3 in terms of this, and that will be available sometime not too long after the call ends. Any questions? Thanks for your cooperation in this. And so, Kurt, I'll let you. We're going to start off on module 3. And I don't know if you want to make any initial comments regarding module 3. If you do, do so right now, and then I'll take a few.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Chuck. So one of my assumptions is that the people on the call participated in the Cairo meeting or tried to participate remotely or read the output from that, so they've followed along. As you know, Module 3 covers the dispute resolution processes where bona fide objectors withstanding can object to applied force strings on one of four grounds that were indicated in the policy development recommendations. So this is actually the embodiment of recommendations 2, 3, 6, and 20, I think. And there's another one about dispute resolution processes being implemented. So this part of the evaluation maps to that. And my last comment is that just to provide an overview, so the modules, the applicant guidebook, are comprised of six modules that sort of map the whole evaluation process. So you apply for a TLD. So module one gives you an overview of the whole process, tells you how to apply, what the fees are. We'll provide the link eventually to the online application system. Module two is how the applicant and the string will be evaluated. So the policy recommendations indicated that the applicant should meet certain criteria and that the strings themselves, the TLD label, should meet certain criteria. So that those evaluations are at Module 2. And that embodies, you know, most of how each application will be evaluated. Then Module 3 applies to whether there's, as I said, a bona fide objection. Module 4 applies to how to deal with any issues of string contention. So, for example, if two identical strings are applied for, how that's resolved. Module 5 then is the steps to delegation after getting through the evaluation process. That includes the base agreement. And Section 6 is just the terms and conditions associated with applying. So that's my introduction.
Thanks, Kurt. And keep in mind that we covered modules 1 and 2 and spent quite a bit of time on 3 in Cairo, so unless there's time at the end, we're not going to go back to those. Again, we will if there is time. We'll see how things go. Now, I'm going to ask for people who would like to initially get in the queue for module 3, understand that you don't necessarily have to get in right now. Time permitting, you'll be able to jump in later, so you don't necessarily have to get in the queue right now. So this ought to be fun with this many people on the call, but bear with me. Who would like, if speak up, please, with your name if you'd like to get in the queue.
Chuck, this is Eric.
Hang on. I'm going to write down names. Who else would like to get in the queue to start with?
Steve Metallis, please.
Okay, Steve.
Tony Harris.
Tony, gotcha. Anybody else for Module 3? Okay.
Cheryl Langdonor.
I'm sorry, who was that?
Cheryl Langdonor.
Oh, Cheryl. Okay, thanks. Got it. Anybody else? Okay, and again, you can jump in later if as long as we're on this one, okay? Remember, first time in, probably after that, unless there's duplicate first names, you can just give your first name. But first time in, give your full name and who you're representing. That can be just yourself in this particular case. So, Eric, would you start off, please?
Sure, this is Eric Martin Williams. And I actually sent my question in writing, and I'm struggling to actually send it so I can read it. Do you have it there?
It's going to be hard probably for Kurt and I to jump around and find the questions. Erica, is it okay to come back to you once you find it?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, let's do that. I would love to be able to jump around, but managing the meeting, I'm not as good at that as Aubrey is on those sorts of things. So, all right, so let's go with Steve Metallitz.
Thank you. Steve Metallitz, on behalf of the Coalition for Online Accountability. Kurt, on page 3-1, in paragraph 3.1, it says, an objector accepts the GTLD dispute resolution process by filing its objection. I just wanted to know, does that mean that the objector will be required to, in some way, agree not to challenge the outcome of the dispute resolution process, such as in court?
Well, I think that's my best understanding of that is that's outlined in the terms and conditions. So I think that people that want to pursue a remedy outside the dispute resolution process can do that. So you're reading under 3.1?
Yeah, it's the last sentence in 3.1, and it has to do with an objector, not an applicant. I thought that the terms and conditions were mostly about what the applicant
right.
agreed to, but I may be wrong about it.
Yeah, so, I think that's the hard wiring of that is in the terms and conditions. What's it say down in Module 6? Because I think it says that, the waiver there goes to the ability to sue ICANN, but that's the only waiver.
By the way, let me remind everybody that if you haven't already done so, make sure, even if you get to ask your questions on this call, that you submit your written questions and comments to the comment site. Either for the particular module, or you can also submit all of them in response to the total guidebook, whichever way you prefer. But please do that, even if you get to ask your question on this call or make a comment on this call. That'll make sure it gets into the record, and if something is not answered adequately, that gives staff the opportunity to incorporate your question and comment into future revisions of the guidebook.
So I don't think that means the objector waives all rights.
Okay, so it's okay. Thank you.
So it would be good, Kurt, I think, if that was made more clear in the materials. That would be my there. Let's go to Tony Holmes. Or Tony Harris, I'm sorry.
Yes, Chuck. Actually, I didn't submit this in writing. It's a very short question. Can I make it?
Sure.
Go ahead, make sure you submit it in writing.
Yeah, I will later. Going to 3.1.1 on page 3-1, it's a paragraph which is titled Grounds for Objection. And if we turn over the page to the last ground for objection, it is titled The Community Objection. You'll find that on page 3-2. I have a confusion here because my question is, since we have two types of application, one can be an open application or it can be community-based. When you say community objection, is this applied to both types of application, open or community-based, or only to those applications that are community-based?
So both
That's
kinds
question.
Of applications. You can make a community-based objection on an open application.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Kurt, and thanks, Tony. Cheryl.
Hi, Cheryl Langdon Orr. I'm representing, in my role as chair, the at-large advisory committee, and I also have my vice chair, Sebastian Bachelet, one of my vice chairs, on the call today. There'll be no surprises about the questions that the at-large community want to raise on module three, but we have provided our questions on each module in writing. It comes to section 3.1.2 on page 3.2 under standing to object, and this, you can take a deep breath, Kurt, it is really a placeholder. I don't expect answers today. It is a matter of our serious concern about morality and public order, and the noting here by us that 3.5.3, as listed, mentions this section is still under construction. What we're seeking is further, not now, specific discussion and input on this matter, and we certainly would like to engage in establishing how community end users, which is our particular part of the world, may be able to effectively learn how they can be involved in such an application for community or objection to either type of application. This is probably going to be via the ALSs at the ground level within the particular country, but it may involve RALOs, and of course it may involve the at-large advisory committee itself. Thank you.
Thanks, Cheryl. And Kurt, I don't know, she obviously isn't necessarily expecting an answer right now, but did you want to say anything in regard to that?
No, that's thanks. Thanks very much, Cheryl.
Okay. Okay, Eric, are you ready to go?
Yes, I am, Chuck. Thank you very much. I actually found my question. So how does the legal right, BRP, substantively differ from the community objection, BRP? That's the question.
Could you ask it again, Eric?
Sure. How does the legal right BRP differ in substance from the community objection BRP?
Well, the let's see if I can explain it. If you read the standards associated with one of those, then that would help indicate the differences. So, infringing the legal rights, there has to be a legal right in place that's being violated, and so you know, it's not too different from you know, other processes with the community-based TLD. Really goes to the misappropriation, I would put the term it as a misappropriation of a community label, which causes that community to object.
That's fine. That's the intellectual property or traditional knowledge.
Eric, just to chime in there, having been very actively involved in the PDP, the GNSO PDP team really recognized that the community-based objection is much more subjective than the legal rights protection.
Well, here's a sense of the purpose of the question, because there's a difference of, what, almost two orders of magnitude in the cost for the two DRPs. So do both of them form judgments about the substantial issue or about the likelihood? That is, if they're both forming judgments on questions of substance or likelihood of detriment, how is it that they cost so dramatically different?
Are you talking about the application fees and the?
How do they cost different? We have some experience in infringement of rights in that it's not a UDRP process, but there's some similarity there, and it's been indicated that WIPO will be the there's an agreement in principle with WIPO to perform those services, and they've performed similar services in the past, and are working with, essentially what I would think is settled decisions and settled law, even though it's sort of a new area. And for the community-based objections, the ICC will be providing those services. They think that the the hours per case will might vary considerably. And so far, we have an hourly rate for that for a single panelist. And so our work in the next couple months that we've taken away from Cairo is to hone those numbers. So in fact, we have staff going to Europe the week after next, I think, to work with each of those firms to, give applicants a better idea what the cost would be for that dispute resolution.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Kurt.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks, Kurt. Would anybody else like to be in the queue for Module 3?
Yes. So this is Edgar Watson with Bank of America Corporation.
Okay. Anybody else besides Edgar?
Mike Rodenbaugh.
Okay, Mike. Anyone else? We have about 4 or 5 minutes on this module, so Edgar, go ahead.
Okay, my question goes both to 3.1.1, grounds for objection, and to 3.1.2, standing to object, and I am very specifically thinking in reference to any hearing that might incorporate or consist of the English word bank. There are significant regulatory restrictions in the United States over entities that can call themselves a bank. And my question is, how would an objection to a string that contained a phrase that was illegal under U.S. law be raised, particularly if it was a federal regulatory agency or it was a bank that was not yet actually an applicant? Where do they have standing to bring the fact that this is an illegal string to the attention of ICANN?
So the objection process would allow for objections in two areas, and so that was the question there is what would be the outcome of that dispute and that objection and the dispute resolution process. So one would be that it would be a community based sort of objection, and the other is that a bank saying that its rights are being infringed would sort of be an objection on that matter. Also, if it's an illegal string, then the objection process doesn't preclude a bank from pursuing remedies under different means. But what the objection and dispute resolution process is intended to do is provide the paths within the process for hearing objections to name and determining whether those objections should be upheld or not.
Well, it wouldn't be a legal right because no bank could claim intellectual property rights simply in the word bank or banking. It would be, the controller of the currency, perhaps, that would be say, under our regulations, no entity may call itself a bank, and there are similar regulations in Europe and other major financial centers, that no entity may call itself a bank unless it is a bank.
Right.
Kurt, let me do a follow-up question there, because I think Edgar is raising a really good question. It'd be great to have clarified, and you might need to get this from the general counsel's office. But so if there was a law in a country that limited the use of the term bank,
mm-hmm.
to use that example, do you think that could the legal rights objection category be used to defend that, or is it specifically referring to a legal right with regard to the string itself? And I don't necessarily, Kurt, expect you to answer that, but I think it's a very good question to get clarified.
Yes, it really goes to whether a company or individual's rights are infringed. And so it could be by the string itself, or it could be from the use of the string. Now, one of the problems is in the application process, we're usually left with little other than the string itself. And so we've asked for in the application for the purpose of the string, but that is also why there's a placeholder in the process for a post-delegation dispute resolution process on the infringement of rights too. I kind of think so. The question would be: is if somebody applies for .bank, whether they're calling themselves a bank or not?
Yes, that's part of the question. Now, let's say a Yeah, something calls it applies for dot bank, but they're not a bank. They don't meet the requirements for a bank. And in fact, it could even be an organization, a community-based organization such as, I'll just pick something out because I'm not suggesting they are intending or were thinking of doing this, but the American Banking Association. It's a trade group. It represents the community in many ways according to the ICANN criteria, and yet the American Banking Association under U.S. law could not call itself dot bank.
Kurt, I have a it's Paul Stern. I have a question. It's related to this.
Go ahead, Paul.
I just wanted to note that I understand the gentleman, you know, I'm not a lawyer, and I understand that there are these regulations in the U.S., but that there are companies that are allowed to use the word bank. And, you know, for example, there's a registrar, Domain Bank. I know that they're allowed to use the word bank. There's sperm banks could use the word bank. So it's not illegal for a company to have, or for the string itself to be illegal just because it has a bank in it.
My suggestion here is that Kurt go back to legal counsel and see if we can get a little clarification on this, and maybe that can be included in the next iteration of the document, or maybe even provided separately. There's also the issue of if in fact there's an implicit connection to a community, and that word's been brought up several times in discussing this, then of course there's the ability to object from a community basis, like the community of banks or whatever, but that's just another thing. Somebody else, was that Cheryl?
No, it's Joyce. I just wanted to say, if somebody's, one of my friends, his last name is Bank, what if some individual want to file that, and it's very legal because Bank is his last name.
Right.
It's Christina.
Hey, Christina.
Christina Rosette, I represent the IPCN Council, but I'm speaking for myself. And this is really just something that I struggle with. It's an earlier module, but this may be an opportunity to flesh it out, is that the concern that has been raised about where you have kind of a problem that doesn't fit neatly into any of the objection categories, that perhaps one use for the public comment mechanism would be almost the equivalent of a letter of protest. In other words, bringing information to the attention of the evaluators that they may not otherwise have. And obviously, you need to have that very tightly defined so that you don't get into the objection areas. But that may be one opportunity for this type of situation to be resolved, or at least addressed.
Thanks, Christina.
George, here. Can I join the queue?
We're going to have to cut Module 3 off here very quickly. George, did you want to get in on the same topic or at the bottom of the queue?
Same topic.
Okay, go ahead, George.
George Kirikos, Leap of Faith Financial Services, Inc. Going back to the gentleman's question about dot bank, he brought up U.S. law. I was wondering what jurisdictions ICANN will respect in terms of challenges to strings. Because there's, you know, things that might be legal in the United States might be illegal elsewhere.
Well, I think ICANN follows rulings of courts of competent jurisdiction, so I don't think
Iranian court,
you know, our agreements state that you know, generally we have arbitration and following the laws of California and the United States, but we have followed in the past rulings of courts all over the world of competent jurisdiction. The problem is, of course, that you know, that can lead to forum shopping. So that's the issue that needs to be addressed.
Okay, let's move on to Mike Rodenbaugh. Mike, please.
Thanks, Chuck. Just curious as to when in the process between now and the date we have the DRP the guidebook finalized, when will we expect to see the dispute resolution process rules completed?
So the timeline is to publish an interim guidebook in February, a final guidebook at the end of May, and then have a communications period after that. So the final rules would have to be in the final guidebook. What you read in the guidebook now are the rules, are the procedures that, that are going to be followed, but there'll be some more detail to them provided by each of the dispute resolution providers. So we've negotiated that set of procedures that you see in the guidebook now with each of the dispute resolution providers, so they'll all follow that. But they'll all also have some, you know, particularized rules about, you know, how to send in fees, what form to fill out, that sort of thing. So in the worst case, that would be in the final version of the guidebook, but like I said, we're we've got some people go working with them in the next couple of weeks to try to finalize all these things.
Kurt, I want to clarify some things you said there. I heard you say that there will be another version of the guidebook in February, followed by a comment period, and then you said the final guidebook in May. But then you indicated that there might be a comment period after the final guidebook?
Oh, no, a communications period. I'm sorry.
Ah, thank you. Very good. I'm sure there are a lot of people interested in that. Thanks for clarifying. Okay.
So I don't know if that answer was helpful, Michael.
It was. Thanks, Kurt.
Chuck, this is Amadeo. I have not submitted a written question on this. May I still be on the queue?
As long as you're brief, because we're out of time for Module 3 and moving on to Module 4. Go ahead,
okay,
Amadeo.
I'll try to be brief. It's just to see whether this is the understanding. Court, in the community-based objections, there is an absolute defense for the TLD applicant, and that is fulfilling the same criteria for having a standing to object, that is being an established institution and having some level of support. This means that in this procedure, a completely split community is not a reason to stop the application, or even submission by a minority, but a still significant minority of the a given community, with the formal opposition of a majority, but not all of the community, is still not something that would be considered as a valid objection.
So let me take a look at that.
I can't point to the page because you were fair enough to send me a text version that could reformat, as I was unable to work with the PDF, sorry.
Yes.
Well, as I see that it's not that fast, perhaps it's better that we handle that in the public comment forum.
Yeah, because my knee-jerk reaction to your question was it was more than a split, you know, that to meet the standing requirement. But that's a good question. And
The concrete formulation is if the the defendant, which is a TLD applicant, meets the same criteria, which means, you know, anything, the same criteria, it means even, right?
Yeah.
Then that's an absolute defense, which means, in my book, having a completely half-and-half split community going along, which perhaps is not a good idea, or perhaps it is. I just wanted to understand the position in the guidebook.
Right.
Amadeo, please submit that in writing to the comment
room
so that it gets documented and less likely to get dropped on the way, okay?
Okay.
Yeah. So I thought it was more than just a split. So, standing there, the filing, refer to paragraph 3.1.2.4. I know I'm taking up too much time here, Chuck. 3.1.2.4.
Okay,
yeah.
Let's move on.
Yeah, let's move on, but note the section there, and if there's time at the end, which I doubt, we can come back to that. Okay? Let's go to Module 4. I think...
Oh, wait, I have... I'm sorry, Chuck. So,
oh, yeah, that's all right, Kurt.
I'm kind of screwing this up here. So, Steve Metallitz, well, I got an IM that said that last sentence you asked about as far as agreeing to abide by the procedures means that... they agreed to abide by the procedures of that process, and if they failed to abide by those processes, the objection could be rejected or denied. So it's depending on the failure. So it really goes to intra-process and decision.
Thank you very much for that clarification.
If that makes sense.
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thanks, Kurt. Okay, Module 4. Kurt, I think you've kind of given an introduction of all the modules, so let's just jump right into a queue. Who would like to be in queue for Module 4?
George here.
George, okay. Who else?
Cheryl.
Cheryl. Okay. Next.
David.
David. Anybody else? Okay, and again, you can jump in later. Was there somebody else? Who was
Jake,
that?
It's Adrian Kindred.
Adrian, okay.
Eric as well.
Eric.
And Christina, please.
Christina. Okay.
JC.
And Amadeo was in.
Amadeo. And I heard somebody else, I think.
JC.
Jason.
JC. Rochester.
Oh, okay. And I'm going to add myself in the queue there. I have a few questions in this one as well. So let's start off with George.
Yes, on the string contention sub-document, or commentary document, page 4, it says, string confusion is deemed to occur if a string so nearly resembles another visually that it is likely to deceive or cause confusion. I'm concerned about the comparison only being visual instead of oral, you know, sound or other forms of input, especially as we move towards, you know, a voice internet and other input schemes. Mm-hmm. So is there a contingency for other means of measuring confusing similarity?
Yes, there is. The way the guidebook is written now, that there's a preliminary determination made by an independent panel to determine if the strings are visually similar or so similar that they're likely to result in user confusion. But in the objection-based process that follows that, an objection can be made that strings are similar, you know, confusingly similar, I hate that term, on any ground, whether it's they sound alike or look alike or, you know, or they have the same meaning or some other way. That
I posted examples, for example, where the sword tool seems to fail because, there, you know, you can get a low number on the sword tool below the 30%. I don't know if that's going to be the cutoff or what will be, but it's a very weak tool.
Well, it's applicable for visual and alphabetic similarity only, and it does do similarity checks across different scripts, but like you pointed out, it is for visual similarity only.
My second question had to do with...
Just a second, George. Kurt, isn't it correct also... Sorry for jumping in, but I just want to make sure this is clear. The tool, the sword tool, is also just one tool that's being used for visual similarity. It is not being used alone for visual similarity. Is that correct, Kurt?
Yeah, so thank you, Chuck. So, yeah, visual similarity is or confusion is a human reaction. So it'll be a decision made by a panel of examiners, and the algorithm will provide, you know, some objective measure of how visually similar the strings are. So there's no... there's no cutoff, and there'll be no requirement for, you know, examiners to, you know, disqualify pairs above a certain score, or allow them below a certain score. But we'll provide some sort of objective guidance for them in making their decision.
Chuck, do you have a follow-up to that?
George, is yours on the same topic that you wanted to continue, or a different topic?
The same topic. I just wanted to add one more thing.
Go ahead, George.
Just to stay on this topic, are we able to get the root zone DNS error traffic that would allow us to add to the reserve list obvious typos so that we don't have to rely on the tool? Because the tool is going to miss a whole bunch. You know, like, for example, .xin, which is just .com, and then moving your finger to the left, is probably not visually similar, but is a typo. If we can get that root zone DNS error traffic in advance, those names can be all reserved and save people, you know, $185,000 application fees.
So that's an interesting point. And I know it's been you know, a subject of discussion in the single name, single letter discussion, where you can miss one. It'd be an interesting study to do. I guess the balancing against that is we'd be drawing great big circles around domains so that we'd be excluding too many. So I think it's something that should be explored.
I'm okay with that big circle,
Kurt. I'm like,
that's right. Surprise.
Okay, we won't go there. Adrian.
Thanks, Chuck. Kurt, just in response to, in your response to one of the questions there, you stated that on the first objection it's visually, and then if you objected through the process, further, you could object on any grounds. Is it your opinion, at least, that you could object for on the grounds that it means the same as another TLD or an existing TLD?
Yeah, so you could object if you think that user confusion would result, and that's a bit, you know, that's something we're supposed to try to avoid. So if you think allowing a string into the root would cause user confusion with another, you could object on, people that can object could object on any ground.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks, George, for the questions there. Did that cover your questions, George?
I had actually one more. The auction proceeds under 4.3 of the main document, is that already decided that ICANN's going to spend it, or can it eventually be used to reduce registration fees for GTLD registrants in general?
So, the auction issue is really interesting. The purpose of an auction would be that, you know, if contending names aren't resolved through comparative evaluation and the parties can't settle the contention amongst themselves, we need some sort of last result mechanism for resolving that. And auction seems to be the one clearly allowable under the law, clearly objective process. We kind of think that if you're in contention with another string, it's much more economical for you to settle it with the other party than go to auction. So
singing to the choir on auctions, I believe it 100%. I just worry about where the funds are going to go.
Yeah. So I guess it's being recorded, right? As far as I'm concerned, we could give it all to charity so we can diffuse the discussion about where the money's sent. But I think that, you know, I think that if we use it to reduce fees, then that means it kind of goes to ICANN to spend as part of the general budget, and that's not what the goal of auction isn't to raise revenue in any way. It's just to resolve this contention. So I think that the money, and ICANN will publish something about this, about where the money could go for comment, but, you know, maybe it would go to a fund to rescue failed registries and just be stuck in an account to provide for that, or stuck in some other stability fund, or stuck in some fund for others to spend. So I think that's something that, we need to post for public comment so that people are satisfied that the purpose of the auction isn't to raise revenue, it's just to resolve this contention, and essentially the way we think is left. But, you know, that's not decided yet either, and there's still discussion to be had about the method we use at the end of the day, whether it's auction or something else.
And, Kurt, didn't I see somewhere in the documents, and I can't cite it right now, but it said that there would be a community consultation effort to decide how the funds would be used, that it wouldn't just be unilaterally done by staff.
That's right, and it might be some other mechanism for spending the funds even out. Yes, yes.
Okay, good. Okay, let's go ahead to Cheryl.
Thank you, and it's a perfect segue because there's two questions we've sent in on Module 4. The first one goes very much to a placeholder again, Kurt, so another deep sigh of relief from you, I'm sure. And the second one goes to the discussion you were just having about auction proceeds. With reference to 4.2.1, eligibility for comparative evaluation, the ALAC, on behalf of its ALSs, please note the separation between church and state here. We are asking this question on behalf of the user communities within country, not ourselves. Is there any role for them, in other words, the community groups established by ICANN as an at-large structure on the ground, probably, we think, in the community-based applications, but we are not sure of that, for them to assist in the establishment of bona fides or other claims in support or otherwise with these applications? There is a part B to that question, and it goes as follows. And to what, if any, extent in the phases of proof of claim in the community establishment or community endorsement parts of this process, can we interject, make modifications or comments?
So if I were to draw a parallel with your comment, would it be like a Friends of the Court brief, or
we suspect that may be a useful role that our already established communities could play. So it's actually an offer, but we need to know if there's interjection points or not.
Yeah. So I think if we look at the dispute resolution process. It is sort of a dispute resolution process, mm-hmm. but that process is to determine, you know, the level of community support for the application. And so the expressions of community support could come from the sorts of organizations that you're talking about. So if I capture that correctly.
Or it may be checking the accuracy and integrity of such a claim.
Chuck, Tony Harris, could I get in queue about this?
Go ahead,
issue?
Tony.
Yeah, no, well, I don't think Cheryl's done. Did she have two? Did you have?
Well,
Tony,
I'm assuming you're following up on the same issue.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Go ahead. Sorry,
I'm just
in, and I'll come back to Cheryl.
My comment is very quick about this. I mean, communities not necessarily mean communities of individual users.
Okay. Good point. Now, Cheryl, back to you.
Absolutely, and we certainly see that is, we're not saying everything is going to be geographically based either. The second one was the question to do with auction proceeds, and that whilst we understand that the community consultation on distribution of these funds will occur, the ALAC does wish to have a placeholder here views of the end users, and here we see registrants and non-registrants be taken into account on the matter. Two reasons. First of all, the more expensive any process becomes, we assume, unless people have some very interesting business models, will eventually come back to the registrants. So the registrants have certain motivation to be interested in the outcome of where such auction funds are spent, and that goes to some of the discussion we've had before. But secondly, non-registrants who may be those who will be confused or misled or have trade practices issues or have cross-jurisdictional confusion with the use of bank. It might be that some of the community consultation on the distribution of these funds, comments may come in from non-registrants about education or upskilling programs. I just wanted to flag on behalf of our community that, again, we have structures that may be able to help make sense of these unrelated requests and discussions.
Thank you, Cheryl. Let's go ahead to David.
I'll pass. My question was answered.
Thanks, David. Adrian.
Thanks, Chuck. Hopefully mine's a quick one. Kurt, I'm just looking at figure 4.2, and that's on page 4-4. Actually, the page beforehand gives a little bit of an explanation on 4.3, the last paragraph. It starts with, in contention set 3. It's merely just a quick one. I think the contention set 3 diagram is wrong. I don't know if anyone else has picked it up or whether I'm just misunderstanding it. Very, very quickly, it just says that E and J are in direct contention and that J and K are in direct contention. If S drops out, I think the two diagrams, as it moves to the right of the diagram, should be perhaps E and L or E and I. I think that E and I and K and L on their own. No need to respond to it now rather than maybe just go off and have a look at it and just check to see whether I'm right or it's just far too early in the morning and I'm wrong.
I'll take that one, Kurt, because I think I'm the culprit here.
Well, if Adrian's wrong, we'll post it on the website, and if we're wrong, we'll quietly amend it.
Sure.
Thanks, Kurt. Appreciate it.
Okay, good. And again, make sure that all of these get documented in the comment period. Eric.
Yeah,
section 4.7, or excuse me, 4.2.3 on page 4.7, we have in the first test of the 11 point, or the 12 points for which a community needs to get 11 points to continue, that the string name is well-known, a well-known abbreviation of a community institution. Now, as the caller from the Bank of America pointed out earlier, the ABA actually doesn't have bank in its, they may have trouble with that. More generally, institutions are rarely the names of communities. I think we don't have this one quite right as my comment, but my suggestion, other than changing it, of course, is that we keep track of how many objections fail to achieve standing because they're brought by, they don't meet the community institution test, and similarly how many applications don't make a score of 3 but make a score of 2 because of the imposition of the institution or abbreviation rather than the community's actual name.
Right, so I have that's a good question. I have a host of comments that I hope I can keep straight for you all. one is that this scoring goes to comparative evaluation, so you don't have to achieve this scoring in order to successfully object to another string. That would be a separate, you know, that's the objection-based process, isn't it?
Right.
It's the comparative evaluation process.
Understood.
A second point is that what we heard during the consultations with the GNSO and others during the policy development process, and then as we worked together through the implementation. So two of the comments there were that it was thought that the STLD process had too broad a definition of a sponsored or community-based TLD, and that should really be tightened up. And second, that when the council members and others contributing to the policy discussion described a vision for a community-based TLD, the first thing that sprang to mind was like an indigenous people or something where you said, you know, dot and the name of a people, and you say that is our label, and others should not have it. So, or that should be ours, and we should always win the contention for that. So we started with that, but then, as you can probably guess, in developing the scoring and consulting with others, we did a lot of scenario testing and what ifs. So what if there was, you know, a dot bank or, you know, another name that's sort of generic, you know, that's not the precise community label, then you would not get the full score there. But if you had the, if that community, though, had strong community backing and the other things, it can still score 11. So the scoring was intended to find that balance where, you know, if that was your string, then and it was clear, well, that was one of the big purposes of the process. But if you if it was a more generic term, but you really had strong community backing, you could still carry the day. And I think that's that's the balancing that's kind of struck. And then the last comment I want to make really is sort of the arbitrariness of scoring. So what do we have here? 1, 2, and 3. You know, it could easily be a set of different numbers going up to 5 or 1, 3, and 5 or something like that, where you didn't have to score 11 out of 12. You would the test would be essentially the same, but the scoring would be different. So score, you know, use of a number like 92% or something like that, you know, that's all somewhat arbitrary and can be changed without really affecting the balance. So I think what the discussion here, I can once to hear different scenarios or why this model might fall short or especially why another model might be more suitable is not really about the 92% number. It's really about the balancing that needs to take place between what is a community-based TLD and how tight does that have to be to meet what the policy recommendations
implied and suggested schemes for that in addition to the one that's suggested here. So I hope that was clear.
Thanks, Kurt. Let's go to Christina.
Thanks, Chuck. I have two questions regarding section module 4. In 4.2.1, is the applicant's identification of its application as either open or community-based dispositive? And if not, under what circumstances will ICANN substantively examine that self-identification and potentially change it?
So could you say the first part of your question again, Christina?
Sure. Is the applicant's self-identification of its application as either open or community-based dispositive?
It is until this contention resolution has to occur. So the only time in this model, the only time that comes into play is during the contention resolution.
Okay.
So if you self-proclaim to be a community-based application, then you're signing up to restrictions in your, you know, in your agreement to follow the restrictions of the community. Okay.
Okay. And then the next question in section 4.3, and I don't have the page number in front of me. What is the rationale for not allowing contending parties to combine to form a new application?
Just that. This isn't probably the complete answer, but it's that we've just done a financial and technical evaluation of an entity that was put together, you know, that has put together this effort, you know, an existing entity probably, or a new entity that was put together for the purpose of creating this top-level domain, and it meets the financial criteria by demonstrating certain facts through publication of its, you know, certificate of good standing and its existing balance sheets, and also has a certain technical plan. So then a combination of entities after that, to me, really restarts that evaluation process. So I think, so the intent was that there are other ways for entities to combine their efforts without creating a new, you know, a new organization that has to be reevaluated.
Kurt, a follow-up question on that is one I had jotted down. I'm guessing that the same rationale applies to why in section 4.1.3, second paragraph on page 4-5, you eliminated the possibility of them forming a joint venture.
Yeah, because because it's thought that that would trigger a new evaluation. You know, a joint venture could be a weaker version of the two individual entities that have applied.
What if they were to, though, do a joint venture or some other mechanisms where one of the proposals was kept intact? In other words, the joint venture is committing to everything that was in one of the proposals, so that there's no compromise of that, and yet they solve their differences in that way. Would that then be different?
Well, I'm sure there's a lot of ways to skin that cat. Where a new evaluation needn't be triggered, and the parties can figure out how to combine in order to have some sort of joint way of moving forward. But I don't. You know, there's so many different scenarios of combining entities that...
George, I think I've got a solution.
Go ahead, George.
All you have to do is, if you have two contending applications that want to combine, just one of them kills itself off in exchange for 50% of the shares, and the shareholder agreement can happen, you know, after the TLD goes to the root or something, so you just delay it until after the application process is over.
It's both for her, Chuck. I have a comment, too.
So that's one with I'm happy to hear the comments. I also want to hear Christina's reaction to what I said.
Paul, go ahead.
No, I mean I understand the rationale, but on the same token, if A was qualified sufficiently to get past the initial evaluation phase, and B was qualified sufficiently to get past the initial evaluation, to me this is kind of a form over substance approach.
So
it seems to me that you know, if you're combining the two, then of course they would be qualified.
But you know, I know two companies that merge and the stock price goes down, or the market cap goes down.
because somehow it's perceived the combination of those two things are less stable or less valuable than the first. And there's also scenarios where they combine to form a joint venture that's not funded as well as they were individually. So there's so many different scenarios that I don't know. I want to talk about it some more because evidently, like I said, it wasn't probably a complete answer, and I think I'm probably missing the boat on some.
Think the appeal of it in terms of the interest that I've seen is that it frankly voids what many perceive to be the whole auction scenario.
Yeah. So we're encouraging entities to settle their differences and get rid of the contention. So, I want to talk about it some more because this idea is really planted firmly in my mind. So obviously, my mind is not going down the right path because there's smart people that think I'm wrong. So I want to understand it more fully. So let's continue to talk about it.
Okay, Paul.
Okay. I thought that the reason that was there was because if two companies form a joint venture, it's a new entity which has not applied, has not agreed to the agreement or anything. So that's the whole reason why, we can't have joint ventures after the fact. If they want to get together, I agree with George, one of the entities withdraws, the other one goes forward, and it maybe has different shareholders, or maybe it has a rest share agreement, or whatever. That's the mechanism. As long as there's not a new applicant or a different applicant from the one that applied and signed all the agreements.
This is Edgar Watson speaking.
Just a minute, Edgar. I'll get you in there.
All right, thank you. I'm sorry. It was set right on point, but I'll wait my turn. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I just want to let Paul finish.
That's kind of done.
Okay, go ahead, Edgar.
I understand here. I'm just urging the greatest possible flexibility and the opportunity for. If the goal is for parties to settle their differences and not go to auction, I think you have ruled out from the beginning and just sort of without any avenue to explore a very fruitful way of settling differences. And the mechanism that's been proposed by two speakers that. The answer is for one organization to withdraw and then post approval of application to receive 50% of the shares of the other entity. That's just not going to work in the business world. If you were requiring an application to be submitted by a, quote, established institution, and so, again, I'm just taking us as an example, Bank of America Corporation files an application and there is a contention with, say, Wells Fargo, and then we have an agreement simply in order to resolve the string contention, one buys 50% of the shares of the other, the antitrust department would go berserk.
I think you'll find that it's going to be optimal for almost every applicant to set up a clean shell corporation to do the application. So you would just merge the shells. You wouldn't merge Bank of America, obviously.
Okay, I want to move on from this one, but Kurt, let me make a suggestion here. I think a lot of people in different ways are making a point that being too rigid in terms of what can happen in terms of two or more parties working together probably is detrimental to what you want to accomplish. And some of the things that you're concerned with, for example, having to start the evaluation process over or whatever other things might need to be done in some of these cases could be handled, I think, by the appropriate qualification language in this particular area. But rather than continuing to debate that and talk about ideas, I think we've covered this one pretty well, and I thank Christina for raising it. Let's go to Amadeo.
Okay, I have many issues regarding this module. Most of them going to some sort of the same concern that was expressed now, is that I think that we are missing some mechanism to minimize conflicts. And it's very well intentioned, but I think it's too rigid in many areas. But I won't discuss that because I think in writing would be more useful, the discussion. Now, there is one question that I would like, again, understanding whether this is what was intended. We have more than one community-based applications. More than one of them succeed in the evaluation, the comparative evaluation, that is a score 11 or 12. The solution is apparently auction. Now, let's imagine two scenarios. The first scenario is that, imagine .cat, where, you know, the Academy of Language and the universities on one side, and the Academy of Sciences, the schools and the publishers on the other side, apply more offer .cat. Well, I don't think that ICANN should encourage civil wars, so to speak. Or let's imagine a .travel, where IATA and CETA apply for it at the same time, or .aero, wherever. Right? I don't think that in the case that you really think that there are two very well-qualified institutions that are somehow unable to even find an agreement because there's no way after the submission to change the strings or join a force. They are forced to go until the end. And having community-based applications into an auction, I think, is not a very good idea. Now imagine the second one. Imagine that .cat for the Catalan Linguistic Cultural Community and .cat for CATs. How you will auction that? I mean, it's a very bad situation for any of them. Think about, you know, .spa for resorts as an open one, .spa with also, you know, the language score for Spanish, for, you know, Spanish Linguistic Cultural Community. It's a very bad choice, .spa. But anyway, let's imagine that. And a third .spa for something else. I mean, in these situations, especially when it's for the same community, shouldn't you say simply that there's no consensus in the domain could not be created instead of forcing them into an auction?
So what was the very last point, Amadeo?
The question is, in case of more than one TLD application passing the comparative evaluation for the same string and the same community, don't you think that simply not creating the TLD is a much better solution? Forcing them to agree and come in the next round is a much better solution than organizing an auction within that community? Because that's the current situation, apparently.
So there's two... Let's
imagine that ALAC and DNSO apply for .ICANN.
Give me a chance to understand it. So there's two community-based applications, and
yes,
they're in contention, and they both score 11 or 12, so they both win. So
yes,
there has to be an auction.
Yes.
And so...
But they go to auction also with other applications which are not community-based. All of them go to the auction.
Community trumps regular ones.
No, I don't think so. I think that only the community ones are in the auction.
Okay, but then if both GNSO and CCNSO apply for .IANA, do you think that they should go for an auction?
It's reserved for the candidate.
Well, it's just an example. Let's imagine that.
Two non-profit entities,
yeah,
both are bona fide community applicants. Both represent communities.
Yes.
So who should get it?
Whoever values it the most, market economics.
Well, I think what
easy,
Amadeo is suggesting.
Amadeo.
Just a minute. I think what Amadeo is suggesting is that maybe just forcing it into an auction isn't always the best route.
Right.
There may be cases where it's better to not even issue the string. Now, I'm not going to weigh in terms of what's right. I think he's raising a
Chuck,
question that is worth further consideration. Okay, who else wants in the queue on this?
Paul does.
Paul, who else?
Eric also.
Okay. Anybody else?
Anyway, I just want to make sure. I just want to say, this is Kurt. I just want to say, I was sort of restating Amadeo's question. I wasn't being conclusory about it in any way. Just so I captured it.
Okay. Good. Paul.
I was going to say they're not forced into an auction, like you said, Chuck. They can agree to cooperate, which they can do before they apply, or they could do after they apply. But they're not forced into an auction if they cooperate and decide how to resolve the contention, then there's no auction.
Okay, Eric?
Yeah, I'll make this one concrete. There are three Cherokee nations, the Eastern Cherokee Nation in North Carolina, where I'm right now, the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma, in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, and the United Kittiwa Band, also in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. All three apply for Cherokee. All three get 11 or higher. What do we do? It's not clear that we should auction off, because what we're doing is basically causing, as Amadeo pointed out, strife in a community where no extra strife is required. Not going ahead with awarding one to one may be more prudent than just blindly allocating based on any particular mechanism, whether it's coin tossing or auctioning.
One of the problems I see here, and one of the straps that the GNSO recommendations put on staff, was to make sure that you know, as much as possible, and we know there's limitations to this, you know, it needs to be an objective, measurable process. So if the option of not going to auction in a case like Eric just cited, what would be the criteria that would be used in the evaluation process to pick that, you know, nobody wins type scenario? And I'm not saying we should decide that now, but that would have to be in there to so that there's some objective manner of determining when that case would happen if it was decided to go that way.
Chuck, this is Steve McAllister. Did I succeed in getting in the queue after her?
Same subject, right, Steve?
Yes.
Go.
I was just going to say
I'm sorry, I skipped Eric. I got Eric. You're on, Steve. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that as I read this section 4.3, it doesn't say that there would necessarily be an auction. There would be an efficient means of resolution, and it might include an auction, but I'm not sure that it rules out the kind of solution that Amadeo was talking about. That's just, you know, my... I guess if it's a question, the question is auction always going to be the efficient mechanism for contention resolution if the parties can't agree?
That was somehow also my question. I would say that in some cases, auctioning is the less efficient scenarios I was describing.
Right.
Amadeo, they could get together, the three of them, in this case, and flip a coin if that's what they decided.
No, because they cannot change the TLDs in case there are different communities, CATS and CAT, for instance, the one that we have as TLD, or because they cannot modify the proposals to incorporate all of them in case they want to join for the same community. So under the current circumstances, they cannot join. Only two of them can withdraw, or one of them can withdraw, which is different.
I think they can join in some way.
I agree.
I just
in the CAT to join together. Yes. As long as they don't submit a new application or somehow a new application that hasn't been submitted kind of sneaks in there who didn't even agree to this agreement on submission. One of them goes forward and the other one's agreed to split it three ways with them, or there's all kind of ways.
That's why every application.
Share the revenue, whatever.
So what I think we're hearing, Kurt, is that, you know, some flexibility here is desirable, and it's been communicated in a lot of different ways and with several different examples. Do you want to say anything else on that, Kurt?
Only that to reiterate Steve Metallic's point is that, you know, throughout this document it talks about efficient means of resolution and not about auction. So even though I tried to wax eloquent about auctions before, I want to take the opportunity to assert again that this means of dispute resolution for community-based TLDs that score over 11 in contention, or even in cases where it's not settled yet.
Let's go on to JC.
May I make one last observation, Chuck?
Okay, Eric. Brief, please.
Yeah, brief. It's not about the money. It's about the policy. There are three different policy models, and we need to somehow make it so that only one of them is not the outcome, that somehow there's ability to merge their policies. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric. That's good. JC.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. It was partly answered by Adrian's question before, but just to make sure, the module says that if there is similarity between a name and an existing CCLD, it's a reason for contention. I'd like to know whether, if you take, for example, the word franchise, which starts with FR, is it a reason to kill it from the get-go because it's similar to .fr? Will it be considered by the panel, even if it's immediate first to the CCTLD itself?
I'm sorry, because it starts with the first two letters?
Yes.
Yeah, so
it starts like a CCTLD. Will it be a reason to kill it, or will it still be considered?
Well, I don't. You know, it depends on there'd be a panel of examiners and an opportunity to object. But I think what you're asking about, if I understand, is a comparison between cctld.fr and a full name.
Yes, so
you know, to me, those are not confusing, but.
This is all of today. Take an example of what exists already today. If you take .info, well, that was certainly acceptable in, and not somehow confusable to .io. So I think the case it brings up is, well, I have difficulty seeing that they would be seen as confusing assembly.
Okay.
Thanks. Is that okay, JC? Anything else?
Yes. No, I'm good. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. I put myself at the bottom of the queue on this one. I've got a few questions. One of them, thanks to Christina, was already answered. But in section 421, that's on page 4-6, the second paragraph, it says only community-based applicants may elect a comparative evaluation. ICANN policy states that if there is contention for strings, a claim to support community by one party will be a reason to award priority to that application. Now, two questions in that regard, Kurt. What happens if the claim of support from the community is not substantiated? And the second question is, would the claim to support a community be substantiated before getting to this point in the process?
Right. So the answer to the second question is no, that the only time the community-based appellation comes into play or is considered is during this comparative evaluation. And then I think what your question is describing is whether there, before the comparative evaluation, if there's some sort of predetermination that a certain threshold by an applicant is met to reach, to identify it as a community-based TLD.
Well, isn't that somewhat of a problem? Because let's say there's an implicit community-based app, in other words, an open application that implicitly relates to a community, and then you have one that specifically is community-based. If there's no comparative evaluation, then the community-based applicant would actually be awarded the TLD without any substantiation of their of the basis of their claim that they're community-based.
They wouldn't qualify. This is all of they wouldn't get score very high on the community endorsement aspect of it. So I think
The fact that they're community-based trumps the one that's not claimed to be community-based.
No, unless they score sufficiently high in the comparative evaluation.
But hold on.
Chuck, could I get in the queue?
Just a second. I'll let you in, Steve. But
Olaf, too, Chuck. Paul,
the one that is open is not part of the comparative evaluation.
Correct.
That's correct.
So that's
correct, but your conclusion is not correct.
Go ahead. Let's see. Steve first.
I think this question was raised before, but maybe to clarify, a comparative evaluation would occur. Isn't it true that a comparative evaluation would occur even if there is only one community applicant? As long as there is also a non-community applicant. So
that is correct.
Yes.
Okay, so in other words,
is that correct, Olaf and Kurt?
Oh, yes.
Good.
11 or higher.
Okay. That's helpful.
Okay, so comparative means, in that case, compared against the criteria, not compared against another applicant.
Ah, good point.
Exactly. It may be a little bit confusing.
But that's only if the community elects.
Yes, I understand.
Correct.
Chuck, Tony Harris.
Just a second. Paul, did you get your point made?
Yes, I clarified it.
Okay, and Tony Harris, go ahead.
No, very quickly, I went back to Module 1 here in 1221, which says, for purposes of this RFP, a community-based CTLD is a DTLD, et cetera, et cetera. And it says, an applicant for community-based GTLD is expected to, and you have four very specific requirements here. My question is, do you get through the initial threshold if you identify as a community-based GTLD but do not fulfill these four requirements? In other words, you wouldn't get to a comparative evaluation if you hadn't fulfilled this previously.
Right, so the
substantiation is done up front. That's my point.
Yes, so the answer to that is the only time that substantiation is done is during the comparative evaluation. That if an entity elects to represent a community and therefore elects to restrict its domain, then it passes the initial evaluation, and there's no objection by anyone else in the community, and there's no contention among strings, then that entity can get the top-level domain and be bound by the restrictions it's made. There's a provision for a post-delegation community objection for those community TLDs that claim to represent their community, and then after the fact, the community realizes that it might be abusing the community label, but that would be probably with a different set of remedies. So the community-based test comes into play during comparative evaluation. I think, and if you want to talk about it for a minute, I think part of the reasoning behind this is if you can picture it, an evaluation process where we get many, many community-based top-level domain applications, and we have a set of evaluators, trying to decide many gray areas of whether a TLD rises to the level of a community-based one or not, when in fact, no one really cares or it doesn't really matter. It only matters if somebody objects to that TLD, so there's a path provided for that because somebody cares about it, or it matters if, there's a comparative evaluation. And so therefore, you have to make sort of decisions between two competing entities, and it's not so. We just thought operationally, it was very difficult to set up a panel to spend a lot of effort and probably contention for a part of the evaluation process that didn't provide a lot of value at the end. So I don't know if that makes sense or not, but that's part of the reasoning behind why we just do this test when it's required.
And
thank you, Chris.
Thank you. It seems, Kurt, that there may be a flaw there, but I'm not going to belabor that.
It's certainly a balancing, Chuck. It's not. that's why we're having this discussion now to talk about some of that balancing that goes on.
Yeah, right. No, I got that, and that's fine. Let me go on to my next.
Chuck, I have a question for Paul on the subject.
Go ahead.
This is Tim. I'd like in the queue too.
Okay, Paul, and then Tim.
Kurt, assume that there's a community application, and so therefore it's restricted. So in his application, they've restricted themselves, and then they go ahead and apply, and there's no other applicants for that string, and there's no contention and no objection. Are they bound by what they said on the restrictions, or are they not bound by that?
They are bound by that.
Thank you.
Tim?
I kind of had to join late, so if this was covered, I apologize. Just say so, and I'll listen to the recording. If this is being recorded, I'm not sure. In regards to the community-based applicant, in the Cray report, it talks about the single organization TLD, which might be a corporation applying for a TLD for its employees. Would that be considered a community-based applicant?
Well, I think I don't know. That's a hard question, so I feel like saying that's already been covered, Tim. I think the community, you have to read the community-based criteria. When I read the community-based criteria, I don't get that a corporation qualifies as a community. But, those
if a corporation wanted to apply for a top-level domain and then was in contention with another applicant, then they could enter that contention round, and then you would look down the criteria to determine if that was a community or not.
Kurt, let me ask a couple of specific questions there. Couldn't a employee base of a large company be considered a community, or the customer base of a particular brand like IBM or something? Why couldn't that be considered a community?
Well, maybe. What do you think about that? And in all our discussions about the creation of a community-based TLD, we certainly, we talk about other reasons for it, and certainly not that reason. This is sort of. A discussion that started in Cairo.
This is Ray Fassett. Can I get a comment in here?
Just a second, Ray.
Sure.
Tim, did you have any more on your question there?
No, I just wondered if that was, if it had been considered, just because, in some cases, it might be a corporation found for a string that happens to be a famous trademark. That'd be one thing. But in other cases, it may not be, and there may be other applicants with other purposes. And so I think it's important to understand whether or not, in that case, if a corporation applies for it under those conditions, that it would be given, preference, more or less, over that string.
Thanks,
Tim.
Please comment to Tim from all of us.
Adrian, do you have a follow-up on that, too, please?
Yeah, I'll get you in there, Adrian. Go ahead, Olaf.
Oh, yes, just if it was a corporation and they self-declared as a community, well, it's pretty likely that they would use their company name, and it's pretty likely that whether there would be contention about that particular string, that there would be not necessarily end up in comparative evaluation, but rather end up in the objection processes that precedes the comparative evaluation. Well,
yeah, I don't think that's necessarily true. In some cases, it might be. If we're talking about Microsoft or something, but if you're talking about, even a string like that, Apple or Orange or Acme, then you can see where the situation could arise. But anyway, I appreciate it. Thank you.
That's right. And in Apple, you can have an Apple Growers Association being a pretty strong community, and computer users being a pretty strong community.
Sure. Ray.
Yes, real quick, that drives right to my question. I mean, I think we need clear or crisper definition of what nexus means. The heading is nexus between proposed string and community. to score a 3, it becomes nexus means between the string and the name of a community institution. And now we're trying to define what community institution might mean. Does that include a corporation? So, I think clear definition here is in order. Is nexus to mean a connection between the proposed string and the community, or is it to mean a connection between the proposed string and the community, the name of a community institution?
Yeah.
Those are not the same thing.
I was hoping in all of this is one of the clearer ones. So.
Yeah.
Whether the proposed string is a well recognized label for a community.
Yeah, but that's different than a community institution. See,
those are two entirely different concepts.
So give me an example so I can capture the issue best.
SHRM, .jobs, right? So they file for SHRM, and that's fine. That's the name of their community institution.
Right.
That's not necessarily the name of a community. Or actually, what is the nexus? That's the question. What is the definition of nexus? The connection between the string and what? The community?
Yeah, so...
The name of the community institution? So there's an inference that the name of the community institution therefore represents the community.
Yeah, so I think I think the intention here is that it would be well recognized. So, I know who SHRM is, and maybe many on the call don't, but SHRM is clearly tied to that society.
and of human resource managers. And so rather than dot human resources, that might be a little more distant. So, you know, dot BSA, Boy Scouts of America, yeah, at least over here, is fairly well known, but, you know, dot Scouts doesn't have, you know, quite the nexus. So if it's the Boy Scouts of America that are applying for a string, you know, it's more arguable that dot BSA is their string rather than dot Scouts. So the intent was to kind of capture that distinction.
Marcus, Paul, I have a question.
Yeah, just a second. I think Adrian's next. Go ahead, Adrian.
Yeah, I was just picking up on something Kurt said earlier with respect to when he said, I believe that corporate domains were, he didn't think that they fit into community. I'm just picking up on the definitions of open GTLD. I think I agree with him because it says an open GTLD may or may not have a formal relationship with an exclusive registrant. Kurt, would it be fair to say that exclusive registrant in this case could be a corporate?
Well, so yes, that's certainly true, but then that doesn't necessarily preclude the community question, and I think we, you know, like I said, this is a fairly new discussion about that, given the identification of sort of a brand, TLD, so we should continue the discussion of this in the comment forum, and, you know, I can to provide some sort of draw man for that for discussion.
I'm sure that this is one that will need to be clarified in the next edition here. Paul?
Back to Nexus. You know, the GNSO talks about community and these community, you know, the whole community intent. I'm under the assumption that it's not intended to kind of capture all the broad generic words there are into a community. Otherwise, it just makes some whole mockery of the process and the original intent of community. Is that assumption correct, that, you know, Nexus is just the whole idea of community? It's not supposed to capture these generic words.
So without passing judgment exactly, the intention of that Nexus line, and you get, you know, the 3 points if you if that's your label, then you know, that is the intent of that, and that was meant to capture what we heard during the GNSO discussion. And as I described before, there is a path if it's less of a nexus, but that requires a really strong community tie and other things. So it's not, you know, it's not the be all and end all, but it's certainly very important in the test.
Chuck, this is so, can I get in the queue?
All of here, could I? Well, perhaps one.
I heard Olaf. There's somebody I missed there. Who was the other person?
Sorry.
Olage. Let Olaf go first, Chuck.
Okay. Very quickly, that perhaps this nexus, one could express it in mathematical terms, that there is a one-to-one relationship and reversible, so that there would be a clear one-to-one relationship between a string and that particular community. So it wouldn't cover more or less in any direction.
So you're saying it's not reversible. In other words, that's what you said. In other words, the label is yours and not somebody else's.
No, not sure. Reversible in the meaning sense, that it covers the community and nothing more. That particular community that is intended.
Like Boy Scouts of America, boy, if they selected boy, that would not make a two for them.
Well, that does cover more than Boy Scouts, doesn't it?
Yes. So you're saying, I just want to be clear.
That's
you're
just,
saying,
well, thinking aloud here.
Yeah.
How to express it.
If they selected boy, it would not make it two. Is that correct?
Well, that's why we have evaluators.
Yeah, right.
It's above our pay grade.
I could never get that job.
But I do think... Keep in mind... The evaluators are supposed to be given objective criteria that they use And that's what we're talking about right now. It was never anticipated in the GNSO that the evaluators would make subjective decisions without having some clear, measurable criteria to use. So let's keep that in mind. Now, I understand that you can't totally eliminate subjectivity, but we want to minimize that as much as possible. Let's go to Mike Pelage.
Well, so any of the comments that anyone has had toward making these criteria more objective would be so welcome.
Understood.
Okay. Mike.
Thanks, Chuck. Mike Pelage. Mike, again, Paul, to address your question with regard to whether the term is a generic or a commonly used word or phrase, if you recall when we had this discussion and this, if you will, class of names kind of sort of surfaced, it was during the last spring when we met in Marina Del Rey. And the two examples we used at the time were .bank and .library. And what we were talking about was how the scenario we wanted to guard against would be sort of an entrepreneur coming forward, some VC saying, I want .bank, as opposed to a group of the World Bank Organization coming forward and saying they want a .bank. So the two examples we used during this discussion when this concept was framed was the example of a .library and a .bank. And the only reason I raise that is it was not a prescription to preclude a generic use of a word in connection with the community. So that's the only kind of disagreement or at least a difference of opinion I have on that that linking on the application.
And I think that is an accurate assessment of what went on in the PDP. So okay.
So Mike, how do you think this the scoring then captures it? So if it is a very specific name that's right on top of the community, you know, you get your 3 points. If it's not, then you get your 2 points. But you know, by having strong dedicated registration policies, strong community establishment and endorsement, then you still can meet that score criteria. So
I guess my question, and again, I was going to submit this in the written comments, is the point system, part of the problem I have with the point system is someone could have an 11 versus an applicant could have an 11 and an applicant could have a 10. And under the ICANN definition, we have a clear winner versus a scenario where someone gets 10 and someone only gets 4 and is not a clear winner. My concern, and this I think does go to Paul's concern about, does Boy Scout that incorporates boy, is that a 3 or is that a 2? And then the other point of concern, which I think Margie Milam from Mark Monitor raised during the consultation and which has been acknowledged here today, is most corporations or most entities applying for a TLD are most likely to do that through a clean shell corporation. And if you look at the longevity criteria, which is one of the other ones, a newly formed entity would automatically drop that person down to a 2. So someone, as we said, if the Boy Scouts wanted .boy and they created a new shell, they're already at 10, precluding them from ever becoming a community-based application. So I think it's that type of rigid analysis which I think is somewhat problematic. And if you recall, Marilyn Cade talked in Cairo about the potential of creating a little more shading instead of a 1 and a 3, perhaps a 1 through a 5 ranking, because I think with the 1 to 3 ranking criteria, you are probably going to get some unintended results or outcomes. And as I said, I will come up, as I said, in the written comments on some potential ideas on objective criteria, because again, this is a very difficult scenario and one which potentially could be gained by applicants. And then
I have a comment.
Go ahead, Paul.
Michael, it doesn't say that the community institution is the applicant. Otherwise, it would have said is string is name of well-known abbreviation of applicant. So, because it doesn't say that, I interpret that to mean that the community institution does not necessarily be the applicant. It doesn't have to be the applicant.
Okay, and I want to move on past this one, but let me make a general observation going back to the history of the PDP on this. You know, there were a couple of them at least of the 19 recommendations that we recognized were more challenging in terms of the objective criteria aspect than others. This certainly was one of those, and we acknowledge that. I think the staff has done a good job at making a crack at this, but I think we've also realized in the discussion that we've just had in the last 20 minutes or so that this is definitely one that some continued discussion and more input on the comment forum and so forth is very definitely warranted. Now, before
hey, Chuck, real quick, just one quick comment, Ray, real quick, okay?
Make it quick, please.
I will. It just dawned on me that, see, I thought these A, B, C, and D were going to be evaluated mutually exclusive. It's dawning on me that how you answer in B may affect how you score in A. Is that a correct observation?
So, well, this is Kurt, so I don't think so.
Okay.
And also, I think... I'm not sure, but I think I agree with Paul Stoher that the community establishment criteria calls for a clearly identified, organized, and pre-established community of considerable size and longevity, but it doesn't require that the applicant be of a certain longevity. So, you know, I think that can be clarified. I just want to check on the thinking of, in the development of that, and then we think that can be clarified.
Thank you, Chuck and Kurt.
Chuck, this is Steve Metalis. Could I just ask, since now we've now been at this for 1 hour 45 minutes, how long is this call?
I'm going to talk to that right now, Steve.
Okay, thanks.
Before we finish module 4, obviously my goals have been superseded by great discussion on module 4 and some on module 3 too. So obviously we're not going to get through all the modules. I want to at least finish module 4. The call will end at 2 hours. Okay. Because I think to go longer than that is tough, and of course we've got Kurt on vacation. Many of you are on vacation too, so we're going to cut it off at 2 hours. Now, I did ask Kurt yesterday whether or not he was available to do another call next week. Some of us are involved in the IGF next week, which makes it a tough week. I'm one of those, and Aubrey's one of those. So we might even have to do a call the following week, but that would put us past the end of the comment period. Now, a 1 week extension of the comment period would probably accommodate that if staff was willing to do that. Since the multilingual comment period is ongoing anyway, that might not be a bad idea. But so let everybody know we're gonna end this in about less than 15 minutes. And hopefully we'll finish Module 4 by then, and Module 5 and 6 would be covered in a separate call either next week or the week after. So one of the problems next week is it may be very difficult for either Aubrey or I as chair and vice chair to chair the call, depending on the timing, but it'd probably be bad for us in any way. Now,
Chuck, it's Adrian. Can I speak to that, please?
Yes.
Just real quick, you just said that it would be a good idea to, if we could potentially delay the comment period by a week. Can I just put a little appendix to that, if you like?
Sure.
That so long as it doesn't impact any timeline going forward.
I agreed. I totally agree with that. And that's why I made the comment, Adrian, that considering that you have the multilingual version of the guidebook comment period that's going to extend a little bit past, I don't think extending it by a week should have any impact at all on the ultimate timeline. Now, Kurt, do you agree with that assessment on my part?
Well, maybe a week. So, anyway, that's something we could talk about for a long time because we do have the multilingual comment period extending longer. But I know that there's extensive, important comments that are coming in, and I
can't.
Well,
keep in mind, though, we've pretty thoroughly covered modules.
Yeah.
We will have pretty thoroughly covered modules 1 through 4, so it's not as if work can't continue on those before the end of the comment period.
Right.
So.
Chuck, alternatively, you could learn Russian or Chinese in 1 week.
I know. This whole thing could be gamed, Amadeo.
Okay. Now, I do want to finish module 4, and I have several other questions since I had put myself last in the queue. In section 422, which is on page 4-6. The very first paragraph says, The panel's charter is to determine whether one of the community-based applications clearly and demonstrably would add more value to the Internet's domain name system. How is added value determined? Now, I really don't necessarily think that the criteria that are used to score people necessarily shows added value.
Well, that's what's intended. So I don't know if that's unfortunately worded, but the sole criteria for determining this is in section 4.2.3.
Right, I'm gonna come to that. I have some questions on that are kind of related here. It also, that section 422 says open applicants within the contention net will not participate in the comparative evaluation. Now, that's correct, right? They will not.
That's correct.
Okay. So an open GTLD would lose to a community-based GTLD if the community-based GTLD passed the evaluation.
Scores 11 or 12, right.
Yeah, with 11 or 12. By the way, going back to a comment that Mike Pelage made, it's possible that a score of 11 may be overly restrictive, especially since since some of these definitions are somewhat subjective in terms of value. An open GTLD could only win against a community-based GTLD if all community-based GTLDs were unable to substantiate their community support and didn't score at least 11 the way it's worded right now. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, Chuck, can you say that again?
Yeah, the only way an open GTLD could win against a community-based GTLD, if there's contention, okay, is that the community-based GTLDs were unable to substantiate their community or had objections, however that might happen, or they didn't get a high enough score in a comparative evaluation. Is that correct?
Yeah, so the community-based string would have to score above a 10. It'd have to score 11 or 12. Then the community-based string wins in the way this scenario is constructed.
And so the open GTLD that has string contention would lose automatically if they get 11 or 12.
Right.
Okay. All right, and then does an open application that's implicitly focused on a community get the same treatment as a community-based application in terms of the community impact?
No. So the strings that identify themselves as a community-based string have the opportunity to be considered in the comparative evaluation and also are required to follow the restrictions that they propose as part of their community-based TLD. So the asserting that you're a community-based string has the positive of has the positive of the CHIT in comparative evaluation, and then the, I would call it a burden of being required to comply with the restrictions.
Okay.
Hey Chuck, this is Jeff Newman. Can I ask a follow-up?
Sure, Jeff, go ahead.
So Kurt, a couple times during this call you said that those community-based would be required to follow the restrictions that they set forth. I just want to note, even though this probably relates more to Module 5, that there's nowhere in the base agreement where that is set forth. There's nothing that ties
the...
Finish, there is one thing that says that everything you said in your application was true and accurate, but that's not the same thing as requiring you to follow through with everything you said.
And it's not in the specifications anyway.
Hmm. So that's something to take note of and to check.
So it'll certainly be incorporated into the agreement, those restrictions.
Okay. Going on to section 423 that you mentioned, Kurt, page 4-7, the table that's there that shows the how points will be applied, 3, 2, 1, et cetera, that some people have already talked about. One that struck me was is that there's 3 points given under for an applicant that that registration eligibility is strictly limited to members of the community and so forth. That gets a higher score than 1, gets a 3, and then only a 2 is given to a registration where registration eligibility is predominantly available to members of the pre-established community. but also permits people or groups informally associated with the community to register. It's not at all clear in my mind that the second one is of lesser value than the first one. But I just raise that. I'm not asking you to evaluate that. It certainly doesn't seem odd. It actually seems to me that the second one could be of more value to the broader community than the first, but that's just an opinion on my part that I'll communicate and leave it at that.
Yeah, I think I understand your point exactly.
Yeah. I don't know how we answer that, but I just wanted to point that out. For community establishment, the third column in that table says there's 1 point if no community is addressed. Well, wouldn't that be an open application then? And shouldn't it be a zero? I don't know. That's probably a minor point, but I throw that out. That's probably a good one for Olaf.
Yeah, so if you get a one, that means you're 2 points down and you're not going to win. So it doesn't matter.
Well, I understand that, but it doesn't even seem to be applicable, because if there's no community address, then it would be an open application, would
right.
it not? Yeah, okay. Under community endorsement in that table, in the first column, 3 points, endorsement by a recognized institution or by member organizations. Does that mean there's no opposition at all for the 3 points? I don't know. Again, I throw that out for you guys to grapple with.
To make clear, right.
Yeah. I think a little more detail to differentiate the scores would be helpful there. And then in 4.3, page 4.8, third paragraph, it says, those withdrawing cannot apply for a new string. I'm assuming that means it can't in the current round. They could apply for it in a later round.
Of course.
Yeah, I think probably a minor thing to clarify there. And then next to last, section 4.4, page 4-9, and also page 5-1, the second paragraph, if the winner of the contention resolution has not executed a contract within 90 days of the decision, I can have the right to extend an offer to the runner-up application. Boy, that seems, you know, if I don't know, after all the investment that people are making to do this, that forcing them to get everything wrapped up in 90 days may be a little excessive. If it was a minor investment and so forth, it'd be a little bit different, but it's pretty significant. And then, go ahead.
This is Jeff Newman. If the contract were in any way fair, it might be easier to get that done in 90 days. But given the current one-sidedness of the contract, requiring someone to execute that agreement in 90 days is just not fair or feasible.
Yeah. And then section 4-4 is my last point on page 4-10. This offer is at ICANN's option only. The runner-up applicant in a contention resolution process has no automatic right to an applied-for GTLD string if the first-place winner does not execute a contract within a specified time. My question there, and you don't necessarily have to answer it now because we're about out of time, but my question is why? It'd be great to have some rationale as to why that happens. The runner-up has invested a lot, too. If, in fact, they're next in line and they qualified, why wouldn't they have a right to be considered rather than only an ICANN's option?
Well, I think this is meant to create options so that, 90 days isn't the hard and fast rule, that there might be reasons for going past the 90 days, and that ICANN isn't obligated at the end of 90 days to offer it to the second place or another TLD applicant, but can rather for reasons, for any number of reasons, some of which cannot be anticipated, can extend that 90-day period. So
yeah,
I'm kind of linking your last two comments together into one.
I think some clarity and maybe a little bit more flexibility in those things would be helpful, but that's just my opinion. Now we just got a couple minutes. Is there anybody else that has anything on Module 4? Okay. What I want to do, first of all, is to thank and compliment everyone on this call for what I believe was an extremely effective use of our time. Everybody followed the guidelines excellently. We even were able to get in people that didn't submit questions, which I think is a positive thing. And so my compliments and thanks for the excellent cooperation and the great contributions. So I compliment everybody on that. And I would like to also suggest we're going to have to, Kurt, if you can work with Glenn and Aubrey and I and in terms of some possible times for another call, in the next day, actually, if we can begin to explore that today, it'd be great, although it's getting pretty late for Glenn. I don't know if that matters for Glenn, but
she was on in the middle of the night last night with me. So.
She's always working in the middle of the night, I know. I experience it all the time. So, again, my thanks to everybody. Make sure that if you haven't already done so, that any questions or comments you communicated today, that those get put in writing on the public forum page. And if you had any of those in Cairo that haven't been submitted to that page in writing, also please do that. Any final questions or comments?
Yeah, Chuck, Adrian, I've got one.
Go ahead, Adrian.
Olive put together a brief summary of questions that were brought up in that session or two sessions in Cairo, and I was of the understanding that if you brought it up in those things and they were captured in Olive's questions, that they would be submitted as comments. Is that not the case anymore?
Well, you know, I don't know. I think suggested that, Adrian, because we had the transcript and so forth. But in looking at the transcripts, it's pretty challenging to do that. Like I said, my recommendation is that you do submit them. I know I ended up doing that myself, and as you know, I asked quite a few questions.
If you want to make sure, then submit them. But otherwise, you could assume that I can at least heard them if they're noted.
Yeah, but don't complain if they don't get noted in that basis.
Oh, I very rarely complain about anything. So.
I know.
Could I just mention, this is all of here, it was meant as shorthand captures of what has already been addressed in order to simplify the follow-up calls like today. So we didn't repeat those questions necessarily, I mean, for your memory only. That was the main intention of it, to simplify, since we covered a lot of ground under Module 1, which actually stretched into both 3, 4, and 5.
Yes, thank you, Olaf. And keep in mind, too, that a lot of people made comments, not necessarily asking questions, in Cairo, too, so you want those in the record as well. Right. And anything else before I adjourn this call?
Doc, this is Jeff. Where is the Olaf document?
Oh, it's on council list. Version 3 was the latest one, and I think that was sent on the 7th of November.
Okay, is there a place you could put it aside from the council list, because a number of us are not members of council?
You don't have to be a member of council to see the archives, Jeff.
Anybody
can go to council, email us, and see the archives.
Sure, but Chuck, can you imagine sifting through those to find the one document you have if you don't get them sent directly?
And that's why it was helpful that Olaf said it was sent on November 7th.
It was.
Okay. So
I gotta bail you guys, but thank you very, very much, everybody, for...
Thank you, Kurt. We appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Kurt.
Thanks.
Have a good week off, Kurt. All right, everybody. This call is now ended. Thanks again, and we'll be talking again in a week or two.
Thank you, Chuck.
Thanks, Chuck.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Are you still there, Glenn? I have a question for you.
Hello?
Glenn, are you still there?
I'm still here, yes.
Hi, George.
George, yes.
Did you send the invitation to everybody who sent comments to the comment mailing list, or just people in the constituencies? Because I think people that submitted comments might want to be notified of the next meeting.
Oh, yes, George. What I did was I sent a notice to the constituencies, that constituency list, where the constituencies are supposed to notify all their members. I sent it to the council list. I sent it to the GTRD list, the people who originally worked on the recommendations, that is the council members.
But,
and I sent it to a lot of individual people that you know, have been faithful contributors.
What I meant, though, is there's actually the already submitted comments. If you grab a mailing list of all the people that already submitted comments in the forum? Kieran or somebody else who manages the mailing list, or not the mailing list, but the comment forum,
yes.
They can probably grab all the mailing, the front address.
Absolutely, yes.
And blast it out for the next.
Yes,
forum.
Yes.
All right. Have a nice day.
Yes. And I've got them all, and I sent all the people who were not on those, you know, not on the constituents list, for example. I sent them all the format that the call was going to take.
Oh, okay. Because I am on, when I submit comments to those lists, I used a different email address, so I didn't get any notification of that email address. So.
Which one? That GTLD one?
No. The thing UTLD, yeah, comment form. I use my Yahoo address for that.
Oh.
And so if it was like automated that everybody who sent a comment got an invitation.
Oh, no. That wasn't the case. No.
Yeah.
No.
This is Eric. I hope not, because we had a really good use of time today, and not everyone who submits comments makes good use of time.
True. You don't want Jeff Williams on the call.
I was just thinking of that name in particular, yeah. But you know, he's not alone.
Thankfully, he hasn't submitted any yet.
And the point of what we're doing is not to ensure that there's equal access to information. The point of what we're doing is to correct the guidebook.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
Should I have been getting Module 5, because that's where I had the most serious concern about, you know, the tier pricing issue.
Well, that's why I think that you should send them to the comments on Module 5, because you've probably seen that for each module there's a public comment list.
Yeah, I did.
And I see that you have done that, George, so that is an excellent thing, because the summary of all those comments will be taken and they will be factored into the revised guidebook.
Okie dokie.
Okay.
Here's where the last one's left. So, bye, folks.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Bye, Glenn.